This is the TED Radio Hour. Each week, groundbreaking TED Talks.
TED Talks.
TED.
TED.
Technology.
Entertainment.
Design.
Design. Is that really what it stands for? I've never known that.
Delivered at TED conferences around the world.
It's the gift of the human imagination.
We've had to believe in impossible things.
The true nature of reality beckons from just beyond.
Those talks, those ideas, adapted for radio. From NPR. I'm Guy Raz, and on the show today, ideas around privacy, or what's left of it anyway, and whether privacy is going to mean anything in the future. So there's a guy in Maryland, his name is Hassan Elahi. He's an artist, he teaches at a university, and you could say that Hassan doesn't have much privacy at all. And the end of his privacy began about a decade ago at Detroit Metro Airport.
So I had an exhibition in West Africa. So I was flying back. And, you know, I mean, as an artist, you go wherever there's work. So I'm flying back and I land in Detroit. And, you know, you're going through customs, the usual thing in immigration. And the guy, like, swipes the passport through and just, like, freezes. And I mean, like, completely white. I'm thinking, okay, what's going on here? And
yeah.
He says, follow me, please. Walks me through, and I end up in a INS holding cell. And I'm sitting in this huge room, and, you know, like, there's all these people from every far corner of the earth. You know, you can see the fear in everyone's face. This is the first day in the U.S., and things aren't going well. And then, literally, like, it's like a scene out of the movies. Like, this guy in a black suit walks straight up to me and just looks at me and says, I expect you to be older. Just bizarre, you know, the stuff. So I'm like, you mind explaining what's going on here? And he said something like, well, you got some explaining to do yourself.
The agent had all kinds of questions for Hassan, where he'd been, who he'd seen, who paid for the trip. But not just questions about that trip. The agent wanted to know details of where Hassan had been over the past 2 years.
Yeah, he's like, where were you on this date? Where were you on September 12th? Where were you on this date? So we read my calendar of appointments. You know, back then, it was my old Palm 505. So we read literally months and months and months.
This is at the airport. He's asking you where you were on specific dates.
Yeah, yeah. So it turns out that I had rented a storage unit in Tampa, Florida, where I was living at the time. So he's like, you know, what did you have in the storage unit? It's like, you know, winter clothes. I got, you know, like furniture that I can't fit in my ratty apartment. I got, you know, assorted garage sale material. And he's like, okay, no explosives.
Okay, so it turns out Hassan was mistakenly put on an FBI watch list. And eventually he got through that interrogation in Detroit. He picked up his stuff and he caught the next flight home to Tampa. And a couple days later, he got a call from an FBI field agent, and he asked Hassan if he could stop by to answer a few more questions. Now, by this point, Hassan was hoping to put any doubt to rest, so he volunteered to take a series of polygraph tests. Hassan picks up the story from the TED stage.
One of the polygraph questions was, well, the first one was, is your name Hassan? Yes. Are we in Florida? Yes. Is today Tuesday? Yes. Because you have to base it on a yes or no. Then, of course, and the next question is, do you belong to any groups that wish to harm the United States? I work at a university. You know? So I was like, well, you know, maybe you want to ask some of my colleagues that directly. But, you know, I said, okay, aside from what we had discussed, do you belong to any groups that wish to harm the United States? It's like, no. All right, so at the end of, after the end of 6 months of this and 9 consecutive polygraphs, they said, hey, everything's fine. I was like, I know, but that's what I've been trying to tell you guys all along. I know everything's fine. So they're sitting to me, they're looking at me, it's really odd. And it's like, guys, you know, I travel a lot. This is with the FBI. And I was like, you know, all we need is a last guy not to get the last memo, and here we go all over again. And there was a sincere concern there. I said, well, you know, if you get into trouble, give us a call, we'll take care of it. So ever since then, before I would go anywhere, I'd call the FBI. I'd tell them, hey, guys, this is where I'm going. This is my flight, okay? Northwest Flight 7 coming into Seattle on March 12th or whatever. You know, it wasn't that I had to, but I chose to. I just wanted to say, hey guys, don't want to make it look like I'm making any sudden moves. I don't want you guys, you know, I don't want you guys to think that I'm about to flee. Just letting you know, heads up. And so I just kept doing this over and over and over. And then the phone calls turned to emails, and the emails got longer and longer and longer.
I mean, so like you had like your FBI agent, which by the way is insane. You had your own, it's like your own therapist. You had your own FBI, and he was on your speed dial on your cell phone.
Yeah, then I started realizing, well, wait a minute. Why is this guy so special? Why is it that only he gets to know everything?
Okay, so this is where it gets a little weird. Because if you go to Hassan's website, it will show you exactly where he is at this very moment. And also time-stamped photos of places he's been throughout the day.
This was the parking lot where I was trying to find a parking space this afternoon, right before I walked into here.
The meal he ate this morning, points along his commute.
At the light before I get on the main road, that's at work.
The toilet he used a few minutes ago.
By the way, you guys have great toilets here in the new building.
It's definitely nice toilets here. Hassan Elahi tracks himself. He turned his interrogation into a nonstop art project to tell the entire world where he is at any given moment. And he calls it tracking transients.
These are some of the airports that I hang out in, because I like airports. Kennedy Airport, May 19th, Tuesday. This is in Warsaw, Singapore. This is a parking lot in Elko, Nevada, at Koreana Supermarket, by my kimchi, because I like kimchi.
But why would anyone want to give up their privacy voluntarily? Here's Hassan's explanation from his TED Talk.
When I first started this project, people were looking at me saying, why would you want to tell everybody what you're doing, where you're at? Why are you posting these photos? Well, this was before an age before people were tweeting everywhere and 750 million people were posting status messages or poking people. So in a way, I'm actually kind of glad that I'm completely obsolete. I mean, I'm still doing this project, but it really is obsolete because you're all doing it. This is something that we all are doing on a daily basis, whether we're aware of it or not. So we're creating our own archives and so on. The other thing that's also interesting that's going on here is the fact that intelligence agencies, and it doesn't matter who they are, they all operate in an industry where their commodity is information or restricted access to information. And the reason their information has any value is, well, because no one else has access to it. And by me cutting out the middleman and giving it straight to you, the information that the FBI has no value. So thus devaluing their currency. And I understand that on an individual level, it's purely symbolic. But if 300 million people in the U.S. started doing this, we would have to redesign the entire intelligence system from the ground up. Because it just wouldn't work if everybody was sharing everything. And, you know, and some of my friends have always said, hey, you're just paranoid. No one's, you know, why are you doing this? Because no one's really watching and no one's really going to bother you. So one of the things that I do is I actually look through my server logs very carefully. Because, you know, it's about surveillance. So I'm watching who's watching me. And I came up with these. So these are some of my sample logs. And I cleaned up the list a little bit so you can see that the Homeland Security likes to come by, Department of Homeland Security. You can see the National Security Agency likes to come by. I actually moved very close to them. I live like right down the street from them now. Central Intelligence Agency, Executive Office of the President. Not really sure why they show up, but they do. I think, you know, they kind of like to look at art. And I'm glad that we have patrons in the arts and in these fields.
So, Hassan, what, like, say somebody like emails you and says, hey, let's hang out. I totally want to hang out. And you can't say, oh, I'm really sorry. I'm visiting people out of town today. Because all I have to do is go to the website and see that you are in Maryland.
Yeah.
At your house.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you can't, like, you can't do that.
No, it gets even weirder when you just don't post for several days. It's like, well, wait a minute. What happened?
What's going on?
What are you hiding?
Yeah.
Yeah. And we might say, look, I don't participate in this. I'm disconnecting. But that's not the case. That's not an option. Your water company knows what time you shower every day. And that's kind of creepy when you think about it. Bruce Schneier said a really interesting thing about Gmail reading your emails so it knows how to pop up those ads. And it's kind of like, well, it's like your dog looking at you naked. I mean, are you bothered by that?
But I mean, Like, my dog doesn't have, like, a bionic eyeball that goes to the NSA.
Well, this is the thing, so...
Yeah, I don't have a dog, by the way.
But here's the thing.
A cat, yes.
I like cats.
Me too, I love cats. We have two. And they have seen me without clothes. But I know that... weird? No, because they're not sending that information to Google or to the NSA. It just stays in the cat.
I don't know. You know, I mean, I've changed my behavior around my cat. But, you know, I think this is the beautiful thing is that, you know, now there are literally billions of people doing this. There's 1 billion people on Facebook alone. That is the third largest country in the world. That completely changes this perspective.
What does that say about privacy and about, like, whether it means anything?
It means something completely different than it meant. And the concepts and the technology are changing so quickly. But when it comes to regulating these things, that's when things get tricky. And I can't tell you whether it's for better or for worse, but I can certainly tell you that this idea of what we think of privacy today is going to be different.
I mean, I guess, like, we should expect that the idea of private things are just not really going to be private anymore, and that we should kind of surrender to it?
Well, maybe not. Maybe not necessarily in that same sense, because if you go back to, say, you know, 100, 200 years ago, maybe we don't even have to go that far back in time. Maybe there's plenty of places in the world right now where you go to that small village where everyone knows everyone's business. And essentially, we're kind of having a similar reverting to that.
Yeah.
But except now it's like billions of people.
We're back to the medieval village.
Yes.
Where the vicar knew, like, what everybody was doing.
Yes. And except now the vicar just happens to be the NSA.
Hassan Elahi, his web project is called Tracking Transience. Check out his talk at TED.com. On the show today, ideas around privacy, and we're just getting started.
There is a difference between the stuff that people put online themselves, like pictures and flights and meals they've eaten, than the stuff that they don't realize is also going into foreign computers.
Your Google searches, emails, big data, now possibly in the hands of governments and corporations? That could matter someday, even for the person who has nothing to hide today.
With today's technology, that information can be saved and stored for decades and then later used against him. Because you show me your Google history and I will find something embarrassing or incriminating from there in 5 minutes.
More secrets and privacy in a moment. I'm Guy Raz, and this is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And on the show today, ideas around privacy, what's been taken and what we've actually given. So in Utah, in a place called Bluffdale, it's about 20 miles south of Salt Lake City, there's a building, and its sole purpose is to store secrets.
We've only seen photos taken from far away of the building, but we know about the size of the facility, and it's 140,000 square meters, which means it's a massive, massive building.
So picture the largest Walmart, IKEA, Costco, Tesco you've ever been in, and now picture five of them.
It's, in fact, the largest data center on planet. And that's where our future data and communication will be stored.
This is Mikko Hipponen. He's a white hat.
It's my job to keep secrets. So
he's a hacker, but the good kind. He goes after the people who make computer viruses.
This has been the last 25 years for me. And you also become paranoid in this line of business. You wouldn't believe the things I do to secure my systems and try to keep my own privacy.
Anyway, that data center in Utah, well, we have a better idea of what might be stored there thanks to Edward Snowden and his trove of classified data from the National Security Agency. And what we do know is that it's the first data storage facility in the world designed to store a yottabyte. So to put this into perspective, if your personal computer has like 60 gigabytes of storage, a yottabyte is 16 trillion personal computers. Here's how Mikko described the place in his TED Talk.
We estimate that just the electricity bill for running this data center is going to be in the tens of millions of dollars a year. And this kind of wholesale surveillance means that they can collect our data and keep it basically forever, keep it for extended periods of time, keep it for years, keep it for decades. And this opens up completely new kinds of risks to us all. And what this is that it is wholesale blanket surveillance on everyone. Well, not exactly everyone, because the US intelligence only has a legal right to monitor foreigners. They can monitor foreigners when foreigners' data connections end up in the United States or pass through the United States. And monitoring foreigners doesn't sound too bad until you realize, in fact, 96% of the planet are foreigners. Right? And if we look back about the forecasts and on surveillance by George Orwell, well, it turns out that George Orwell was an optimist. We are right now seeing much larger scale of tracking of individual citizens than he could have ever imagined.
I mean, you say that Orwell was an optimist. I mean, you think Orwell was an optimist? It's that bad?
Yes.
I mean, I have to admit that a part of me is still like not that bothered by it. I don't know. I mean, I am, I guess, a little bit. But most of me, like, I'm not losing sleep over this. It's just, why should any of us really be that bothered by it?
Because surveillance changes history. In our case, it will change the future. Because we've come to the day where storing data doesn't cost almost anything anymore. It's so cheap to store all data, it's cheaper to keep it than to delete it. And that means people will change their behavior because they know anything they say online can be used against them in the future. And even though you might not be worried about your everyday chores, you don't really know how future will turn out. We don't want to give away any more of our rights than we absolutely have to, because every right we give away, we'll never get it back.
And surveillance changes history. We know this through examples of corrupt presidents like Nixon. Imagine if he would have had the kind of surveillance tools that are available today. And let me actually quote the president of Brazil, Ms. Dilma Rousseff. She was one of the targets of NSA surveillance. Her email was read, and she spoke at United Nations headquarters, and she said, "If there's no right to privacy, there can be no true freedom of expression and opinion, and therefore there can be no effective democracy." And when the leaks started, the very first thing I tweeted about this was a comment about how, you know, when you've been using search engines, you've been potentially leaking all that to US intelligence. And 2 minutes later, I got a reply by somebody called Kimberly from the United States challenging me, like, why am I worried about this? Like, what am I sending to worry about this? Am I sending naked pictures or something? And my answer to Kimberly was that what I'm sending is none of your business. And it should be none of your government's business either. Because that's what it's about. It's about privacy. Privacy is non-negotiable. It should be built in to all the systems we use. And one thing we should all understand is that we are brutally honest with search engines. You show me your search history, and I'll find something incriminating or something embarrassing there in 5 minutes. We are more honest with search engines than we are with our families. Search engines know more about you than your family members know about you. And this is all the kind of information we're giving away. We're giving away to the United States.
But I mean, everybody's sharing all this stuff, like, you know, online, on Facebook, like what they like, who their friends are, what books they read, what music they listen to, and their birthdays, where they live. I mean, they're voluntarily giving away all this information.
Absolutely, they do. And it really makes sense for many people to do exactly that. It's so convenient, it's so nice, it's so easy, and everybody else seems to be doing it. But we don't really understand the long-term implications of all of this, that we all share all of our information to the whole world to be recorded and to be stored forever. There is a difference between the stuff that people put online themselves, like pictures and their trips and flights and meals they've eaten, then the stuff that they don't realize is also going into foreign computers, like, for example, copies of your emails or every single online search you ever do, because all that is being recorded as well. And this applies to normal people. I mean, a normal everyday person who right now has no problem with any government on the planet probably isn't very worried about his Google searches being tracked or his emails being stored. But who knows about the future? Maybe that same person becomes an interesting person in 10 years or 20 years. And with today's technology, that information can be saved and stored for decades and then later used against him.
But how?
Well, let's take an example. I live in Finland. Here in Finland, being gay was illegal in the 1970s. If you were gay in 1970s, you would have been jailed for it, which of course nowadays sounds outrageous. However, if our government would have had the same surveillance tools at their disposal in 1970s as they have today, it would have been trivial to find all the gay people and jail all the gay people and keep them in jails, which probably would have mean that the laws would have never changed and it would still be illegal to be gay. So we don't really know how these new tools that governments have at their disposal will change the future, but it's clear they will change the future.
Yes, part of it is war on terror. And yes, there are terrorists, and they do kill and maim, and we should fight them. But we know through these leaks that they've used the same techniques to listen to phone calls of European leaders, to tap the email of presidents of Mexico and Brazil, to read email traffic inside United Nations headquarters and EU Parliament. And I don't think they're trying to find terrorists from inside EU Parliament. And there are terrorists, but are we really thinking about terrorists as such an existential threat we're ready to do anything at all? But people are cared about terrorists. And then they think that maybe that surveillance is okay because, you know, they have nothing to hide. Feel free to survey me if that helps. And whoever tells you that they have nothing to hide simply haven't thought about this long enough.
But, I mean, how are we ever going to stop? I mean, Miko, the train has left the station, right? Like, we can have moral and philosophical and even legal discussions, but that technology is just going to get better and better and better. I guess I wonder whether, in some ways, we just kind of have to surrender and say that most of our lives just won't be private in the future.
The world is changing, and we shouldn't just blindly accept the change. Just because something is technologically possible, it might not be right. And we really have to think about these things now when we can still change them. And if countries that don't like to be surveilled by wholesale blanket surveillance of foreign countries targeting every single citizen, they should do something about that at a political scale. So we, the citizens of the world, should tell that to our politicians and demand change.
Mikko Hipponen, White Hat Hacker. You can watch his entire talk on the NSA and privacy at ted.npr.org. Is anything going to be private in 50 years or 100 years?
Or is privacy dead and we should all get over it?
Yeah, right. And just walk around naked.
Oh, we have to leave something to the imagination.
This is Beth Novak, and her big idea, open up the government. Does that worry you, though, that privacy is disappearing?
Does it worry me? Sure. But I think we need to stop in this conversation viewing ourselves as the passive victims where data is collected about us and where we are being manipulated. Those things are true, and they are very urgently worrisome. What we need to do is to think about ourselves as active participants in the conversation. You know, we can go out and gather data and contributing it to projects and to communities that are interested in using that data to do good.
And that is exactly what Beth wants all of us to do, citizens, governments, everyone, to break open the doors and start an open government revolution. And she actually did that for a while at the Obama White House. Here's the start of her TED Talk.
I came in to become the head of open government, to take the values and the practices of transparency, participation, and collaboration, and instill them into the way that we work, to open up government, to work with people. Well, when I got to the White House in the beginning of 2009, at the start of the Obama administration, the White House was anything but open. Bomb blast curtains covered my windows. We were running Windows 2000. Social media were blocked at the firewall. We didn't have a blog, let alone a dozen Twitter accounts like we have today. So when we wanted to create our open government policy, what did we do? We wanted, naturally, to ask public sector employees how we should open up government. Turns out that had never been done before. We wanted to ask members of the public to help us come up with a policy, not after the fact, commenting on a rule after it's written, the way is typically the case, but in advance. There was no legal precedent, no cultural precedent, no technical way of doing this. In fact, many people told us it was illegal. Here's the crux of the obstacle. The way that our institutions are designed in our rather 18th century centralized model is to channel the flow of values through voting. Once every 4 years, once every 2 years, at best once a year. This is a rather anemic and thin way in this era of social media for us to actually express our values.
Let me be clear that I think openness in government doesn't refer simply to transparency alone. It's not just about opening a window onto how government works. It's about raising the barn. We've long had the notion for many years that transparency will help government function better. It will be less corrupt. But as we evolve the technology that causes us and enables us to gather much more information, what we're quickly realizing is that transparency by itself is not enough.
Today, we have the opportunity and we have the imperative to create thousands of new ways of interconnecting between networks and institutions. The citizen jury, the carrot mob, the hackathon, we are just beginning to invent the models by which we can co-create the process of governance. Now, we don't fully have a picture of what this will look like yet, but we're seeing pockets of evolution emerging all around us. Maybe not even evolution, I'd even start to call it a revolution in the way that we govern. First phase is in getting better information in. The second phase is in getting decision-making power out. Participatory budgeting has long been practiced in Porto Alegre, Brazil. They're just starting it in the 49th ward in Chicago. Russia is using wikis to get citizens writing law together, as is Lithuania. When we start to cede power over the core functions of government, spending, legislation, decision-making, then we're well on our way to an open government revolution.
Like, open governments sounds great. Right? But that assumes that the government isn't just going to not spy on us, but also, like, if they are going to spy on us, they're not going to let that information get out. Like, how can we trust an open government system when that happened?
You know, the revelations of massive surveillance, I think, reveal to us is not, I would say, simply that we can't trust our government, but that our government doesn't trust us. And I think that's the much greater danger and the much greater opportunity here for us to confront. And the way that we're going to do that, I would argue, is by being more open about how we design systems that work. You know, one of the saddest outcomes of this Snowden affair is that we have so eroded the trust between government and the American people, and especially between government and the technology industry, that it's going to be very hard to get the smartest technologists, whether they're in industry or in academia, to work together with government to really figure out how do we protect ourselves and our communities from terrorists and from criminals and from bad guys.
But, I mean, even with something as simple as Facebook, when you click like on somebody's page, I mean, that's a data point, right? And then say you do participate in like, open government. I mean, how do you know that that data point isn't going to be used against you? I mean, I know it sounds a little paranoid. Admit it.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't sound paranoid at all. I mean, it may sound paranoid in the U.S., but it surely doesn't sound paranoid if you're in Syria.
Exactly.
And it surely doesn't sound paranoid if you're in many countries where we've seen how social media postings has led to somebody being hauled off to the police or to prison or worse. Participating in many cultures is actually actively dangerous. And here, it's potentially just viewed as a waste of time because there's the general consensus that no one's listening and no one cares.
So Edward Snowden gave this video message, and he said that kids born today will never experience privacy. I mean, do you think that's true?
I don't think it's true that we've ever experienced privacy by that token. We used to live in small villages and communities, and maybe now even live in an apartment building with a doorman, or you go to a school or you live in a workplace. None of us truly experience privacy unless we live in a cave, because we are observed, we are watched, we talk about others, they talk about us. I think the point that we are increasing the volume by which that happens with people who are unknown to us is increasingly discomforting for us, and we are having to come to terms as individuals and as a society with what is acceptable. And it's a conversation that I'm glad we're having as a result of recent events.
Beth Novick on opening up the government source code. And in a moment, another TED speaker who thinks we can do the same thing with medical research. We're talking ideas around privacy and openness, what we get to keep, what we give away. I'm Guy Raz. More in a moment on the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Hey everyone, quick thanks to the Great Courses for supporting our show. They produce audio and video lectures given by top professors on more than 500 topics. If you like the ideas you hear on this show, if you love learning, check out the Great Courses. And for a limited time, they're offering up to 80% off a selection of their best-selling courses, including The Art of Critical Decision Making. Sounds cool. Head over to thegreatcourses.com/TED. That's thegreatcourses.com/TED. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz, and on the show today, the end of privacy. So John Wilbanks believes that we will all be a lot healthier and that we could potentially conquer big diseases like cancer if we just stop obsessing so much about medical privacy and start to understand that the things that were designed to protect our privacy are actually making medical breakthroughs a lot harder to achieve. And it starts with a concept called informed consent. Here's John's explanation from the TED stage.
Informed consent is an idea that we should be very proud of as a society, right? It's something that separates us from the Nazis at Nuremberg and forced medical experimentation. It's the idea that agreement to join a study without understanding isn't agreement. It's something that protects us from harm, from hucksters, from people that would try to hoodwink us into a clinical study that we don't understand or that we don't agree to. And so you put together the thread of narrative hypothesis, experimentation in human, and informed consent, and you get what we call clinical study. And it's how we do the vast majority of medical work. It doesn't really matter if you're in the north, the south, the east, the west. Clinical studies form the basis of how we investigate. So if we're gonna look at a new drug, right, we test it in people, we draw blood, we do experiments, and we gain consent for that study to make sure that we're not screwing people over as part of it. And the way we gain informed consent, this tool that is created to protect us from harm, now creates silos. So the data that we collect for prostate cancer or for Alzheimer's trials goes into silos where it can only be used for prostate cancer or for Alzheimer's research. Right? It can't be networked. It can't be integrated. It cannot be used by people who aren't credentialed. So a physicist can't get access to it without filing paperwork. A computer scientist can't get access to it without filing paperwork. And this is an accident. These are tools that we created to protect us from harm. But what they're doing is protecting us from innovation now.
What really depresses me is that all these studies on prostate cancer and all these studies on skin cancer can't be combined. The answer to prostate cancer may be in skin cancer and vice versa. We don't know. The chief argument for sharing this information, to me, is the ability to make unanticipated discoveries.
And this is all because of our misreading of privacy?
Privacy is a piece of it. It's an attempt to protect us from harms that are far less potent than the benefits that we could receive.
And that wasn't the goal. It wasn't the point. right? It's a side effect, if you will, of a power we created to take us for good. We cannot take the information from past trials and put them together to form statistically significant samples. And that sucks, right? So 45% of men develop cancer. 38% of women develop cancer. 1 in 4 men dies of cancer. 1 in 5 women dies of cancer, at least in the United States. And 3 out of the 4 drugs we give you if you get cancer fail. And this is personal to me. My sister is a cancer survivor. My mother-in-law is a cancer survivor. Cancer sucks. And when you have it, you don't have a lot of privacy in the hospital. You're naked the vast majority of the time. People you don't know come in and look at you and poke you and prod you. And when I tell cancer survivors that this tool we created to protect them is actually preventing their data from being used, especially when only 3 to 4% of people who have cancer ever even sign up for a clinical study, their reaction is not, thank you, God, for protecting my privacy. It's outrage that we have this information and we can't use it, and it's an accident. So the cost in blood and treasure of this is enormous. $226 billion a year is spent on cancer in the United States. 1,500 people a day die in the United States. And it's getting worse.
So how would that change? You know, if like more of that information was available to researchers, like if more of that data from cancer patients wasn't kept behind walls.
What I hope would happen is that we would be able to find some of the patterns that are driving cancer. And we're studying it in such small sample sizes right now. You know, when we have to go out and enroll people with skin cancer, it costs anywhere from $500 to $5,000 per patient just to enroll them in the study. And at the same time, we've got tens of thousands of people a day with melanoma and other kinds of skin cancer about whom very valuable data is being generated that could form a natural study. And we're basically throwing that data away. And so what I'm hoping we could do is basically explode the number of people who participate in clinical studies by not having them be forced to enroll in some sort of complex study that they see on the subway, but be able to join a clinical study by routing a copy of their data to someone doing the research.
But I mean, if more of this medical data was available and like easy to combine and cross-reference, I mean, do you think we would have made like more progress on finding out better treatments for cancer and other diseases?
I do. At a minimum, we'd be able to figure out who shouldn't be taking cancer drugs. Cancer drugs have an astonishingly high failure rate. Right? Anywhere between 50% and 80% of the time when we give a cancer drug to a person, all they get is the toxicity. If we knew, right, what the genetic variation were of those people, and we could run complex math on it like we run on NSA data, like we run on Google data, like we run on Amazon data, we could probably come up with a list of 1,000 rare variations that strongly correlate with the drug failing.
So you want people to give this information over voluntarily, like they give information over to Facebook or any other social media platform.
I do, but I want them to have more agency involved in the decision. And what I want is for people with their eyes open, right, understanding the choice they're making, to begin contemplating whether or not to make the choice to share.
So the thing that I'm proposing we do here is that we reach into our bodies and we grab the genotype, and we reach into the medical system and we grab our records, and we use it to build something together, which is a commons. We do it voluntarily. We do it through standardized legal tools. We do it through standardized technologies. Right? That's all a commons is. It's something that we build together because we think it's important. So that's what I do. I've actually started what we think is the world's first fully digital, fully self-contributed, unlimited in scope, global in participation, ethically approved clinical research study where you contribute the data. And you can actually upload your information and have it syndicated to the mathematicians who will do this sort of big data research. And the goal is to get 100,000 in the first year.
Okay, this sounds incredible, right? But I mean, you could see how all that information could be abused, right? Because like information is control.
Right. There are all sorts of great science fiction scenarios for the bad things that could happen if your genetic information becomes available. I don't particularly think that those are very likely. I worry more about bullying. I worry more about trolling because these are things that we know people do anyway. And that's why it's so important not to take the informed consent issue and throw it out with the bathwater, but to find a way to harmonize it so that the people who are in this vast database about whom we're collecting lots of information understand and agree to the risks that they're running. And so one of the great ironies to me of the Snowden era is that it has illustrated the value of metadata to people that aren't nerds. The exact same thing that makes you identifiable makes your data scientifically valuable.
John Wilbanks, he's on a crusade to change medical research. Find out how you can submit your medical data at ted.npr.org. Hello, Alessandro.
Hi there.
So there are a couple things I know about you.
I'm curious.
This is Alessandro Acquisti. He teaches at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh. So you're 40 or 41, roughly, right?
Mm-hmm.
You studied at Trinity in Dublin, at the LSE in London, PhD at Berkeley.
That is true.
Your father's name is Giancarlo. He's a banker, but really his passion was for the piano, and together you wrote an opera about the painter Raphael and his lover.
That's correct.
Alessandro studies the consequences of sharing private information. So that's just like a little bit of information, but even little things can become hugely sensitive information.
Yes, you can start from little pieces and you can build more and more personal, more and more interesting, and sometimes more and more sensitive information.
And how? Alessandro's about to blow your mind from the TED stage.
Back in the year 2000, about 100 billion photos were shot worldwide, but only a minuscule proportion of them were actually uploaded online. In 2010, only on Facebook, in a single month, 2.5 billion photos were uploaded, most of them identified. In the same span of time, computers' ability to recognize people in photos improved by three orders of magnitude. What happens when you combine these technologies together? Increasing availability of facial data, improving facial recognizing ability by computers, but also cloud computing, which gives anyone in this theater the kind of computational power which a few years ago was only the domain of three-letter agencies. Well, we conjecture the result of these combination of technologies will be a radical change in our very notions of privacy and anonymity.
And Alessandro found that it's not that hard to use this technology to do some pretty unbelievable things, like identifying a stranger's name just from a snapshot, or even predicting their social security number from when and where they were born. By the way, all stuff you can find on Google or Facebook. See, what I don't get is, as individuals, we are going to be on the hook for this, right? Because we trade our privacy for convenience, right? Like, I like burritos, right? So sometimes I'll order a burrito from Chipotle, right? And I'll use the app on my phone because it is so convenient. Mm-hmm. And then I'll just walk in and I'll just pick up my burrito and it's already wrapped in that silver foil. It's perfect. And they know every burrito I've ever ordered from them because it comes through my phone, through my app. Who knows what they're going to do with that information?
When you give away personal information, nowadays, you most often get some kind of immediate discount, some kind of immediate benefits. It could be you having the convenience of ordering the burrito from your app and the burrito is ready when you want it, exactly how you want it. It could be you uploading a photo on a social network and your friends click on like, which gives you this little but important psychological boost. Whereas the potential cost of doing so are, first of all, uncertain. There could be no cost whatsoever, or there could be a cost. If there is a cost, it will not happen most likely now. It will happen down the line. It could happen 5 years later when a potential employer sees this particular photo of you and doesn't like this photo at all. Or from your eating habits, I can infer your likelihood of getting high cholesterol or developing certain diseases.
So like insurance could look at your social media history.
Yes, I can certainly imagine it.
I mean, they are the insurers and potential employers and university administrators. I mean, they all have access to this information. They can build a pretty good profile of almost anybody in the world who has ever been on the internet and who has ever logged in.
Well, the individual administrator, the individual employer, or the individual insurance company not yet have the ability of finding everything about anyone. That's something that maybe search engines and social networks can do. As we reveal more and more about ourselves, as the commerce and the trade in personal information becomes more accepted and prevalent, whether indeed there will be shops where I can go and buy all the information about you before, you know, I want to hire you, or before, you know, we go on a date. In a movie which came out a few years ago, Minority Report,
a road diverges in the desert.
A famous scene had Tom Cruise walk in a mall.
The road you're on, John Anderton, no, is the one less true.
And holographic, personalized advertising would appear around it.
John Anderton, you can use a Guinness right about now.
Now, that movie is set in 2054, about 40 years from now. And as exciting as the technology looks, it already vastly underestimates the amount of information that organization can gather about you, and now they can use it to influence you in a way that you will not even detect. So, as an example, imagine that an organization has access to your list of Facebook friends. And through some kind of algorithm, they can detect the two friends that you like the most. And then they create, in real time, a facial composite of these two friends. Now, studies prior to ours have shown that people don't recognize any longer even themselves in facial composites, but they react to those composites in a positive manner. So next time you are looking for a certain product and there is an ad suggesting you to buy it, it will not be just a standard spokesperson. It will be one of your friends. And you will not even know that this is happening.
That's creepy. I mean, that scares me.
You suddenly don't want to order burritos with your app any longer?
I don't order burritos or with my app anymore, no.
Do you know the story about the frog and the boiling water?
When you put them in there slowly and they kind of just hang out and heat it up slowly, but if you throw it in the boiling water, it jumps out, that one?
Right. I've always been wondering, when it comes to privacy, whether we are like the frog in the water, and the water is slowly getting hotter and hotter, and then it's boiling, and we just stay there. Because the need to disclose and to share is a very important human need, but so is the need for privacy.
Are you worried about where this is going?
I am concerned, and not in the sense that I expect to live in a Big Brother 1984 kind of world anytime soon. In fact, I am more concerned about the Brave New World kind of scenario, where we have willingly given away our autonomy in exchange for a little bit of convenience, in exchange for an app which makes buying the burrito we like much faster, much easier. I do believe that one of the defining fights of our times will be the fight for the control over personal information. The fight over whether big data will become a force for freedom rather than a force which will hiddenly manipulate us. Right now, many of us do not even know that the fight is going on, but it is, whether you like it or not. And I will tell you that the tools for the fights are here, the awareness of what is going on, and in your hands, just a few clicks away. Thank you.
Alessandro Acquisti, he's an associate professor at Carnegie Mellon University. You can see his full talk with some amazing and alarming photos at ted.npr.org.
Baby, do me a favor. Keep our business to yourself. Please, darling, do me a favor. Keep our business to yourself. I don't want you to tell nobody in your family, and don't mention it to nobody else.
Hey, thanks for listening to our show on privacy this week. If you missed any of it, or you want to hear more, or you want to find out more about who was on it, you can visit ted.npr.org. You can find many, many more TED Talks at TED.com, and you can download this program through iTunes or through the NPR smartphone app. Our program was produced by Jeff Rogers, Brent Bachman, Megan Kane, Neva Grant, and Sanaz Meshkinpour, with help from Portia Robertson-Migas and Eric Newsom. Our intern is Rund Abdel Fattah. Thanks to our partners at TED, Chris Anderson, June Cohen, Darren Triff, and Janet Lee. I'm Guy Raz. You've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Don't you tell nobody, and don't mention to nobody. Please, darling, keep our business to yourself.
So now that you're done listening to the TED Radio Hour, how about checking out another NPR podcast? It's called Snap Judgment with Glenn Washington. Snap Judgment is storytelling with a beat, stories that connect and captivate and invite you to listen closely. Check out Snap Judgment on iTunes under podcasts.